It was Happy Bowen on 24th December 73.
Yes, I think we got the answer. A's equipment was much lower frequency, and therefore more likely to get something from the sun,
right.
Which is also much wider beam.
Also because of a bigger beam, right.
So the sun would stay in for a much longer time. That's probably true.
You don't know anything about the what the Germans were doing parallel to this, do you?
In radar, yes, but not. I mean, as far as I'm aware, they had no concepts of radio astronomy from that group.
But well, can you say a little bit about what they were doing in radar relative?
Oh yes, they in 1939, at the beginning of the war, 1939 and 1940, the German military certainly had no concept at all of what you could do with radar, and they walked right into it. It was a complete absence of knowledge on their part during the Battle of Britain that led to our winning that one.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd come in at 50 feet over the North Sea, for example, there'd be no warning. They had no concept of the operational use because they didn't have equipment.
Right.
But they caught up very fast, and their principal developments were around about 50 centimeters. They had both the receiving and transmitting equipment to do it, and by 1942 or 43, they were probably had better radar cover in Europe than we had, air warning cover in Europe than we had in England.
Because the equipment was better, or because it was more complete?
Because the equipment was better. It is that much later. We still had the old stuff.
I see.
Operating in England. It's the old problem. We stuck with the old techniques. But the German radar cover was built up during that period, 1940 to 42. So by mid 42, 43, they were in very good shape.
I see.
Also, the one other place they were in advance that they did have a radar ranging set in the Navy, on their battleships. And if you recall, they had some pretty good successes, the Bismarck.
Oh yeah.
Sank the Royal Oak, or not the Royal Oak, sank the, something that was chasing.
Yeah.
In the first salvo. And that was because of radar range.
I see.
They had very good range out of line of sight.
Right. Why was it that they developed these marvelous Würzburg dishes, which were so important to every other country radio astronomy after the war?
I think just good German engineering, that they always specialized in heavy engineering. And they also had, come to think of it, some prior experience with a dish on the Brocken. Do you remember that? What's the name of it?
The Brocken, a ship?
No, the Brocken is a mountain in the middle of Germany.
No, not familiar with that at all.
They had a dish there. Operating before the war, so we didn't put it on from there.
Well, so you have a recollection that on the same place that the modern Stockard dish is at, that there was a large one pre-war.
Right.
Okay, I'll check on that.
Probably the Würzburgs derived from their experience with that. Telefunken
right.
was company.
That's right. Right. I have talked with Franz, actually, about a little bit about his role, only on the telephone, but that was interesting.
Set me going again.
Pardon? Set you going again. Okay, so I think you've covered all that you heard about radio astronomy during the war.
By the time I went out to Australia, that's right, and I went out to Australia in January 1944.
I should ask about these reports. I've seen a reference to a New Zealand Air Force report about picking up the sun during the war. Do you know anything about that?
No. I remember Pawsey mentioning it.
Right, he quotes it.
I can't remember it at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I went out in January 44, still on loan from the British, by the way. I was on loan from the Air Ministry for 2 years to help with the radar effort in the Southwest Pacific, because the MacArthur and American headquarters was in Brisbane, was in Australia at that time. So I spent the next 2 years helping with the radar effort there.
Was it a separate development going on there, or was it more a matter of
it had been stimulated from England in 1939, and there was the Division of Radiophysics existed at that time, especially for radar work, as the radiation had especially set up. Now, there was an interesting transition at the end of the war, when the end of the war was imminent. Some big decisions had to be taken in Australia, and they were taken at the political level, that CSIRO would no longer, after the end of the war, do do the military research. This would be done by the defense people and Department of Supply and so on. And the Division of Radio Physics would revert to peacetime radio. Peacetime radio physics, shall we say. So, in 1946, I first of all had the choice as to whether I'd go back to England or stay in Australia. I had offers from both places and decided to stay in the Division of Radio Physics as chief of the division.
Is that where you worked from 44 also?
Yes. I was deputy chief from 44 to 46, and I was the offer of chief of the division in 46, so I took that. Now, the main job I had to do in 46, of course, was to recast the research program of the division, which was a delightful task, because here was a going laboratory. It had 200 people. We had stacks and stacks of wartime equipment, either available to us or readily accessible. So we started a wide-ranging program covering a number of fields, what we thought were promising fields, like radio navigation, applications of radar to various civil activities like survey, and but one of the most exciting things that we started to look at, of course, were all these radio astronomy matters which we knew about, and that would follow up in an active way.
I guess, did you start in rain physics that early?
And rain physics too. We are using airborne radars to look at, we had been looking at echoes from ice crystals and snowflakes and so on in cloud, in a casual kind of a way. In the latter part of the war, it's perfectly obvious that there were a lot of processes going on in cloud which the meteorologists didn't know about, so these were worth investigating, so that was a big program. And our intentions were quite clear, to try three or four or five of these promising things, and not necessarily to continue with them, but put an intensive effort into whatever looked the best. And the two that really came out, of course, of that were radio astronomy on the one hand and the rain and cloud physics on the other. And this, of course, is where a good number of other people came into the picture, particularly Pawsey. And he became easily the most active and stimulating individual on the radio astronomy side. He was aware of all the same things that I've mentioned. Hayes' work, Southworth, Dickey, and so on.
What was his What was his background? I know he got his degree at Cambridge, but can you briefly tell me what else?
Yes, he was Australian-born, University of Melbourne, had an 1851 scholarship, which is one of the best ones you could get in those days, to Cambridge, took his higher degree in Cambridge. Then he worked for EMI on antenna systems, particularly transmission lines and antenna systems. He had a big part in building the first TV transmitting antenna at Alexandra Palace in London. That was the first TV transmission.
So he stayed in England then?
Until the war had already started, I think, or I forget when he took his degree, his PhD in Cambridge. But
it was 32 or 3, I think.
That's right.
I hadn't seen his thesis when I was there.
Yeah, I see. And he worked for EMI for quite, let's say, up to 1939, at which point he went back to Australia to get involved in the war effort there. And either he spent some time with us at Pawsey, by direction from the Australian government, before going out to Australia, or he came back again and spent quite some time, 3 or 4 months, picking up the radar techniques.
Where was that again?
In Bordsey. That's the Air Ministry Research Station.
Near London? Or?
90 miles east of London, up the east coast. Bordsey Research Station, which is where all that work was done. So he spent some time with us. That would have been before the war. And later, of course, he spent some time at MIT, radiation lab, picking up the microwave stuff.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
During the war? Or?
Yes. That could have been 40, 41.
So that's when you were there also?
Well, I vaguely remember. Yes, that's right. This is when I was there also. And whether that was a separate trip from Australia or whether it was the same trip, I can't recollect. Anyhow, he had plenty of contact with these endeavors, and it's the kind of stuff again that even during the war we used to talk a lot about, wouldn't it be nice if we could get onto this kind of stuff. Just by way of reminiscence, by the way, Lovell worked for me there in those years in England.
I see. at the same station now.
At Bordeaux, the same station. You remember, or you might recollect from the record, that the Cambridge physicists were recruited lock, stock, and barrel and were distributed among the Air Force, Army, and Navy. Cockcroft, for example, went to charge of the Army radar. Lovell and a good many others came to us, and he was working for me. Ryle was another one. He wasn't reporting to me directly, but he was working in adjacent group.
The same station, yeah.
So there's a lot of common elements.
Right. It also appears that the American, British, and Australian radar groups were very much in contact.
Yes. Well, we had liaison British. I was perhaps the first British liaison officer to come over here. Set up the British-American links, and by 1941, certainly there were Australian people from the Division of Radiophysics here in Washington, and several of them spent quite long periods up at Radiation Lab and elsewhere in the States, of course. So the links were very, very close.
Yeah.
Now, where are we?
We were talking about Pozzi's background. So he worked at the Radiophysics Lab from 1941, or after he left the Radiation Lab for a few months.
Well, that is a visit.
Yeah, that was a visit, I see.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, from his return to Australia in 1939, in fact, he worked for the Division of Radiophysics and paid these visits to England and to America, and he was predominantly working on air warning problems right through the war, with particular reference to the antennas and feed systems. So it is natural that he would pick up a radar set in the cliff and look at the sound and so on, which is what he did. The next event of significance, I think, is that having decided to go for radio astronomy.
Now, when was that that decision made?
That was we were in fact going for it in 1946, and it was during 1946, 47, 48 we were building up staff. We already had a hard core of extremely good, mostly engineering.
Right.
Well, there were a number of people with a joint BSc-BE of Sydney University. And it's surprising how often that BSCBE comes through. Practically all the people in the Division of Radiophysics have a joint physics and engineering.
Science and engineering, yeah.
And it proved extremely useful. But we were looking for staff, and we got around half dozen in the next year or two. But two in particular, of course, were John Bolton and Paul Wilde. And extraordinarily enough, they both came from the same roots and by the same route. They were both born in Sheffield. They both took short Cambridge degrees in physics during the war, 41, 42 or thereabouts. They then went into the British Navy. They were radar officers, one on the King George V, another one on an aircraft carrier. And they ended up in the British Pacific Fleet in Sydney Harbour at the end of the war.
I see.
And they liked the place so much they started looking around for jobs. And Bolton, we only had one position we were advertising. Both Bolton and Wilde applied for it, and Bolton got it. So we had enough for a while. So we took Bolton literally off a ship on Sydney Harbour.
Right.
And that was the British arrangement, that their staff, their people, officers could team up in Sydney before they'd taken back to England. John Rodney took on, Paul Wilde went back. He applied for the next vacancy we had, and again was refused for some reason. We had a better appointee, and then something else happened, and we appointed him. But I remember interviewing him in London for that job, I think in 1948. So you probably appointed Bolton in 46 or 47.
And then it's a year or two later.
And that can be checked.
Right.
Incidentally, have you seen the recent issue of Nature?
No, I haven't.
Which has got an article by John Bolton which covers some of these things.
I see. Yes, I'll check that. I still haven't quite got the answer yet as to... It seems like you very quickly made the decision that radio astronomy you wanted to go with within a year or something, it would seem.
Easily, really.
Yeah, once you started.
Sure. Well, the potential was so good. As you'll find in the literature, of course, Pozzi struck it extremely lucky in February 1946.
That big,
the biggest sunspot they'd been in donkey's years. And he did all that beautiful Gretchen funny work. And, you know, right. really put the thing on the map, and that was well in front of, we knew all this well in front of publication, of course.
Yeah, the publication was somewhat delayed on that, you know.
Yes, which in some cases we were cross about. It was we think it was not deliberately delayed, but people were not pulling their finger out to bring the Australian ethic to the fore. And there certainly were cases in which we had made some observations first. Ryle heard about them, followed and made the observations, and he got his publication in before we did.
Well, their style was much more something in nature.
Yes, well, so did we. We caught
up. Well, that, right, then you started on that, yeah. But let me ask, is it correct to say that that first work with the Cliff Interferometer was really using exactly the same techniques as have been used from ships for ranging, so that these things had all been worked out to do with the refraction and...
Ranging and height finding.
Right.
That was the technique for height finding and was used prior to the war, 1938. This was the technique for height finding we used at Bawdsey in 1938.
I see. So that was developed in England, actually.
Yeah. So I sometimes worry about this on the grounds that I don't want to detract from what Bawdsey did in 1 minute. But even our own people are goggle-eyed about this. Bawdsey, in fact, invented the Cliff Interferometer. Far from it. That was a pre-war invention.
It was just a very clever application of these techniques to astronomy. Yeah.
Sure. Mm. And the realization that it was an interferometer.
Right.
Gelled about that time.
Right, and also I think that's the first mention of the idea of a Fourier transform is in that paper.
Yeah.
By McCready et al.
Sure. Yeah. That really. Put it on an entirely different footing, but the concept of direction finding on the minimum instead of on the maximum was, I'd say, pre-war. Which goes right back, if you like, to Friesen Lemuza in the USA, in his big array. Looking for similarities there.
I see, that's right.
And there was corresponding work in England done by Wilkins, who was the other man involved in the radar thing. He was doing the downcoming angle measurements on the transatlantic path at the English end, and Friis was doing it at the US end.
The downcoming angle from the ionospheric reflection.
That's what Friis was doing, essentially. He was waving the maximum of his mesar beam up and down and determining downcoming angle.
I see.
Wilkins was doing it by steering a minimum. He didn't have a big array, he only had a interferometer. So it's an old technique.
Yeah.
Well, let me think. You know all about Bawdsey's work on the sun, so I needn't expand on that.
Well, I know about it only from what's published, really. I mean, anything you can tell me.
I don't think there's anything additional that needs to be said, apart from this point which I've just made, which doesn't come through in the literature.
Another thing that has struck me, though, is the way that it seems like the radiophysics group was hauling their antennas on their backs all over southeastern Australia. I suppose this is because they were just used to this. I mean, these were radar, very portable outfits, and so they took them wherever it was most convenient.
We were very noise conscious and were particularly anxious to get out of metropolitan Sydney, of course, because we could get to such low noise regions rather easily.
You're right. But using different height cliffs and things like this.
Now, the other two significant events, I think, are reasonably well covered in the literature, except perhaps the next breakthrough, as far as we're concerned, was Bolton's observation of point sources and identification of point sources, Crab Nebula,
right?
What have you. Now, that again was done well in the fangs of what appears in the literature. We were thoroughly familiar with the fact that there were point sources up there, that they could be identified with things long before the Cambridge group were on the ball. And I personally give a lecture, and I can't recall the details, at the Cavendish Laboratory in 1946, but I told them two things. One was that the temperature in the outer regions of the sun was 1,000,000 degrees, and the other was that you could identify point sources, and Ryle got up and denied both of them.
But in 46, it was the identifications were already known, that early, because it wasn't published till 48.
Sorry, wait a minute, I'm terribly sorry, am I? Now, I may be wrong about that date. I was certainly in England in 46. I was also there in 48, so perhaps it was 48. Anyhow, in advance of publication of any of this by the Cambridge group.
Right, well, that paper by, I think it's Bolton, Stanley, and Slee is certainly a classic paper where they have the three identifications.
Sure.
But let me ask about a previous paper by Bolton alone, where he has what turned out to be indeed valid radio sources, but the positions are vastly wrong.
About a degree out, yeah.
Oh, no, 15, 20 degrees. They're really wrong.
I see.
And then later there's a reference by Pawsey in a review that he got his refraction calculations wrong, apparently. But what I don't understand is how he did that when all these techniques were so well known, like we were just talking about. Because he was using the seek with interferometer also.
No, I can't comment on a refraction error. It wouldn't be more than a degree.
I guess I'll have to ask him.
Sure. Yeah. No, I can't comment on that.
Yeah. But there were about seven sources, and you can see exactly, for instance, he had Virgo and Coma Berenices.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see what each source is now, but they're quite a bit off. And then, of course, when they did the later paper, just a few months later, actually, it had all been tidied up somehow.
Well, that is the next significant event as far as we were concerned. The other was Paul Weil's work on spectroscopy of the sun. And here again, of course, is a very simple connection back with radar, or the radar days. You'll recall that interest in the spectrographic work on the sun began with an observation of a burst on two different frequencies by John Bolton and Ruby Payne Scott.
That's right.
Which
were
about a minute apart.
Right, the delay.
And there was a hell of a discussion went on as to whether the clocks were right, you know, that kind of thing. And I well remember it got quite acrimonious as to how to do this experiment in a reasonable kind of a way. And they were all talking in terms of clocks and tie lines and God knows what. I got very irritated and said, look, for God's sake, you see, in the room above my office were all the intercept receivers used during the war to check on German and Japanese radars. And these were sweep.
That's to determine their frequency, you mean?
Yeah.
I see.
Sweep receivers, it's just swept through and...
And then to jam them.
Displayed the incoming signals on the cathode ray tube, pick the frequencies and jam them. But here were quite sensitive receivers with a 2-to-1 frequency range on a rotating condenser.
I see.
There they were. Any pick your hand is in, pick your receiver. So I said, for God's sake, go and get one of those. Connect it up to your wideband antenna and you've got the answer. That has been forgotten, by the way. Other people now take credit for for the use of the sweep receiver.
Right.
But I clearly recollect I was the first to tell Paul Weil to go and do it.
Mm-hmm.
In no uncertain terms. And if anybody wants to check me on that, I also have a pre-war patent for a navigation system based on a swept receiver. I think it's dated 1934 thereabouts. In other words, I was fairly familiar with swept receivers.
Right.
So that's how the spectrometer.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that came directly out of radar.
Yeah.
Also. Yep.
Oh yes. So Paul grabbed that, and away that work went, of course, from Paris to an extraordinary extent. Perhaps the other early thing I haven't covered properly is the million degree.
Right.
Of course, his million degree work on the sun, which he had wrapped up pretty early, and he became very full of this question of what is an antenna looking at, and what is the noise source and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And for a time, if you recollect, he reverted to long-wave, upward-looking receivers in which he measured the temperature of the atmosphere.
I see. No, I didn't realize that.
The temperature of the atmosphere, yeah. At different depths, different depths of penetration using different frequencies.
And when was he doing this?
He was doing this in 1948. There's some papers by Pawsey and Gardner.
Oh, that's right. Not in the Australian Journal of Scientific Research.
Not sure.
I think.
Where
but I think.
Were.
Yeah, I think I have seen references to them.
Yeah,
yes.
In the IEE in England. Though.
Yeah, that's right.
So all this is relevant.
Right.
Here was Pawsey.
He was thinking of the analogy with the solar atmosphere and corona.
Right. He first of all did corresponding measurements in the atmosphere, so it was a small translation to take that to the sun.
Right.
and D.F. Martin was involved on the theoretical side.
Mm.
He picked this up pretty smartly. Directly recorded in.
I was going to say, do you agree with that story?
Too damn right.
Although it's funny.
He's got it dead right. Martin was a rogue. Tried to make out that he thought of Gola first, and then he told Fozzie to take the measurements. Absolutely wrong. Fozzie had done the measurements, knew the answers.
But it's funny, though, that in the actual paper, Fozzie gives a credit to Martin for suggesting this problem, or something like that.
Mm.
It doesn't look at all like Hayes' story, but is this only because Fozzie was being a diplomat?
Fozzie was being. I should, not for the record, I mean, you can record it, but don't say anything about it.
Right.
D.F. Martin was the original chief of the Division of Radio Physics.
I see.
He got the sack and I replaced it.
I see.
So it was a very difficult situation. Fozzie was the nut in between the jaws of the nutcracker.
Yeah. And what about, while we're talking about this, well, not obliquely anyway, the collaboration between Stromlo and CSIRO, it seemed to be pretty good for such an early stage anyway.
Well, let me give some credits and some in the reverse, that the director of Mount Stromlo at that time was Woolley, later Sir Richard Woolley, a astronomer royal.
Right.
He was the biggest enemy we had in the development of radio astronomy. And he was sitting at Canberra, which is the among the heads of government.
Right.
And he made no bones about it, but he regarded this as a waste of time and a waste of money. And he used to tell politicians, and this is not for the record, look, there's money being wasted on this business of radio astronomy, we've got to cut it out.
Is this because you think he couldn't understand it? Or
he couldn't understand it. He's a traditionalist from way back.
Yeah.
I mean, positional astronomy is all right, but all this newfangled stuff, tubes and this kind of stuff, you know, what they're up to, computers.
Yeah. Yeah, he did write a paper in 1948, in Monthly Notices, in which he tried to interpret he commented that about H2 regions and how they might create radio waves.
Yes, that's true.
Had he come around a little bit by then?
He came around a little bit. He still wasn't seeing light. He didn't agree with money being spent or anything like that, but he was prepared to accept that some of these things might have a reality. Bracewell, if you talk to Bracewell, has a very good story, which I'll repeat.
Okay.
That at a AAA, I should say AAAS, ANZUS meeting, which is the same as the American AAAS in Brisbane, and I can't put a date on it, but you can identify it from the fact that it was at Brisbane. It could have been 1950. Dick Woolley, as he then was, gave the lead paper in astronomy and physics, which he combined, the title of which was The Future of Astronomy. And in the lecture going on for an hour and a half, he made no mention of radio astronomy whatsoever. Bracewell happened to be in the audience, and at the end, there was no formal questions, but at the end, he went up to Dick Woolley and very politely, and in the hearing of quite a number of people, said, Dr. Woolley, you talked about future astronomy, didn't once mention radio astronomy. What do you think where do you think radio astronomy will be in 10 years' time? And he thought for about 30 seconds and said three words. Four words. It will be forgotten. You get that from Bracewell.
Right.
Don't write it up in quite that way, but that's true, absolutely.
Yeah. Amazing.
So we had quite serious political difficulties in that sense. Now let me give the opposite. The boys down the line, and particularly Alan, Player,
right,
who ended up University of London Observatory, extremely helpful. And of course he was very knowledgeable on the Sun, so a lot of the development of ideas on the Sun went hand in glove between Bozzi and Player.
Right, and there was actually a receiver set up at Mount Stromlo, wasn't there?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
That was a bit of D.F. Martin, but he wanted to get in on the act. Oh, and Player was interested in all the day-to-day changes, you know, which we weren't doing. We weren't doing daily observations, instruments and so on.
Right.
He was interested in that. And, of course, D.F. Martin had one thing to his credit. He got the first polarization of the sun, of sunspot.
Yeah, right. What is your opinion? Should he be credited with the first in that paper where Pazzi gives it the million degree, mm-hmm. and then the accompanying paper that Martin wrote? Should he be credited with giving the first good theoretical explanation different depths?
Sure, that was it. Yeah. No doubt about it. But it came after the observation.
Yeah.
From that.
So there was both the good and bad relationship with the opera. But,
yeah.
But on the other hand, with other radio astronomers, there was virtually no contact, I think, with optical astronomers at this early stage.
No, probably not. Mm-hmm.
So you were better off in that respect.
The other man we should mention is Harley Wood at the Sydney Observatory. Well, he was very helpful to vote in identifications and positioning astronomy generally.
Although he never took part in the publications.
Never published, no. He was just somebody who consulted.
Yeah.
He was sympathetic.
I should ask about your publications, of which I don't think there are many in radio astronomy in those early days. Was that because you were just spending all your time politicking? Or?
Yes and no. I think let me be quite specific about this, and please tone it down when you come to write about it. But my history was I took my PhD at King's College in London under Appleton, Professor Appleton, in 34 or thereabouts, 35, I went straight into the radar thing with Watson Watt. And, well, let's skip the rest of the war. When I went out to Australia, D.F. Martin had been head of the Division of Radio Physics. In all three cases, there was one characteristic that stuck out a mile with Appleton. Any work that was done by his students came out under the name of Appleton. E.V. And by way of commentary, Appleton is unique in that for all the work that he's done over the years, and he had some extremely good people work for him, none of them ever got an FRS. This is for the record.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, Watson Watt unquestionably invented radar. There's no doubt about it. He is a man. This is well authenticated and so on. Having invented air warning radar, he then considered he invented everything that followed, including airborne radar, which he had no connection with whatever. In fact, he didn't fly in a radar-equipped aircraft until about 1942, but he still considers he invented it.
And when you say the radar he invented was ground-to-air?
Yeah, airborne. Mm-hmm. And that was done by other people, but certainly he produced the concept. And we come to D.F. Martin, the Division of Radio Physics. One of the most serious troubles that he ran into, there was a lab of some 150 people or something. He was trying to run that lab as if he personally did and was responsible for evidence, you know.
Yeah.
This is something which
I learned. See the picture,
You see, you get the picture.
Right.
When I became chief division radio physicist, I was going to be quite certain of one thing, that if any people did any work, they would get the credit for it.
Right.
So, let's say I was trying to be as helpful as I could all the way along the line, and I was not going to jump in and claim credit when somebody else did the work. The spectrograph is case in point.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I'll give you a dozen help. So, if you can throw that in in the appropriate way, this is why my name was not... Well, let me also say that during that period, 1946, when our first publication started to appear, you probably got the list of publications.
Yes, I do, yeah.
For the first year or year and a half, I personally wrote damn near every paper that came out. They were an appalling lot of writers. I've never seen such rubbish in all my life. Of course, he was particularly bad. And one paper of his in the IEE, the Million Degree paper, took 2 years to be published. That's one reason. I finally quit. I stopped rewriting it for him. He insisted on doing it certain ways, which were bad, and it wouldn't get through the referee. But don't make too much of this. But
I
book on radar. We have a book on radar.
That's right.
Each chapter of which is written by a different person.
Right.
If you've read through that book, into it. You have a look at the style that runs through that book, and tell me who wrote it.
Right.
So a lot of preparation was done, sure, to gather of figures and all the rest of it by those people. Mm. I got it. I wrote that book. So what I'm trying to say is that my previous experience of some pretty hard cases is that the best way to get first class work out of people is to give them the credit.
Right, make sure they get the credit. And apparently also you were not able to have the time to do any research of your own, just the effort to run the place.
So, right. Yeah. It was 220 strong. Mm-hmm. We had a wide range of interests, radio astronomy, dark physics, things like survey, things like the navigation work. It took a lot of time, so right. I just wasn't in the picture.
Pawsey was the chief of the radio astronomy section from the very beginning, wasn't he?
Yeah, mm-hmm. He was head of that.
Right.
The Parkes telescope, of course, was different. I put a lot of my time into that, not only fundraising, but design-wise. Put a lot of time into the design and into the contractual arrangements for it.
Okay, well, let's go back before we get up to that now. So I think you mentioned Bolton and Wilde's early spectral work. What would you say is the next outstanding thing?
I think that's it as far as the beginnings are concerned. Mm-hmm. Well, from there on, it branched in so many fields. I wouldn't really select any. Well, I should let me put it this way. But by the middle 50s, we had a pretty good run in the simple interferometry, and the question of more complex arrays were coming up, of course. And that's where Mills and Christensen came into the picture.
Right.
And Mills had a brainwave, of course, literally a brainwave.
Right.
Inventing the Mills Cross. And I don't know whether you're familiar with the thinking at that time.
No, tell me.
That was the real invention. That everybody knows about a linear array, an outside array giving a fan beam, east-west array giving a fan beam, right angles to it. Similarly, if you cross them and correlated the output, it is perfectly clear that if you had a sine wave, a signal coming in on the intersection, you could extract it from the noise. But it wasn't clear that if it was noise coming in, random noise, and you cross correlate, it clearly would in fact define the beam.
I see.
That's part of discussion. Does it or does it have? And of course, Mills, the only way to find this out was to try it. And Mills built a 100-foot, was it?
Right, he built a small model,
100-foot array, and that was to test the principle.
But whether a noise signal would...
By cross-correlating, you would, in fact, define the central beam.
I see.
From the top there.
No, that's not clear from the paper either. That was the outstanding question. Yeah. The Mills and Christian.
No, well, it's
Mills and Little
easy
paper.
To skip that, but before the event, you see, it wasn't at all clear.
I see.
No, a lot of argument went on about that, and they established the principle. Or Mills established the principle with a small capacity,
right,
1,000 foot or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, Chris was following along, Christensen with his shorter wave crosses, in effect. So that was the significant development of the mid 54, I think it was. Those thoughts were going around at 52 to 54. So the mid 50s up to the 60s were dominated by that kind of activity. Now the big antenna, the Parkes antenna, concept of a big dish was went back to certainly 1950, 49 even. And to some extent, it was indigenous, we thought this is the way to go, but it was stimulated by the fact that Lovell was leading this bandwagon in England. And it certainly looked like a good idea to me. Frank Kerr was another one who backed it right from the jump. Now, there have been various controversial statements made from time to time that I was against the Christensen efforts and the Mills efforts. You're completely wrong. I was glad they found the money so that they could do it. I was backing it. But certainly by the late 50s, 59 or 60, my own views were made up that there were severe limitations to what he could do. The Mills Cross, And the next step was particularly in relation to shorter wavelengths. And the big dish was the answer. This gave you the requisite resolution.
And by that time, a choice had to be made, I understand.
And a choice had to be made. Big money was involved, millions of dollars. And you just can't go around raising money of that kind without a very specific project in mind. So some choices had to be made. And as far as the division of radiophysics was concerned, the choice was clear cut, that we wanted an instrument which would, for that kind of money, would go on for 25 years or more, would still be a force in the radio astronomy field. And secondly, which could be used more or less simultaneously by a large number of people.
Had some flexibility, yeah.
We had 20 or 30 good radio astronomers at that time. And some of these proposals, as they then existed, some of the Christensen proposals and those proposals were unmanaged, which, as a laboratory, we couldn't afford to make it.
Well, I suppose one can say that the science had developed to the point where it wasn't the entrepreneur building his instrument. Rather, it had to serve
the... Now it is a group aspect. It became important, and that's the way we had to look at it. So that particular argument took place in relation to the Parkes telescope, and consensus at the end was that's the way to go, that's the way we went. Most people were pleased about this, except for Milton Christensen. Anyhow, they reached the top of the tree. This is another factor which has been forgotten, that by that time, thanks to my advocacy, they had reached the top of the salary brackets, and we couldn't pay them anymore. We had a lot of people pushing right against the top. So it is only natural that they move on, and the university is a good place to go.
Well, this is mentioned, I think, in Paul Wilde's little story. He says that it was top-heavy, basically, and people went to other places.
Sure.
While we're on this, do you agree with Hayes' recounting of this controversy?
No, very much so. He's got it pretty right. There was only one thing I seem to remember was a little bit off, but I can't off the top of my head remember what it was. Continuing the story, by the early 60s, when the Parkes telescope was in existence and starting to show its metal, Paul's proposal for a heliograph, which is the next big step, of course, was well in the mill and well formulated. And when it came finally to some second choices, would we go, having completed the Parkes telescope, we can then think of the next step. And Paul's heliograph was still competitive with Mills crosses and things like that. And again, having the Parkes telescope, the most logical thing for us to do was to go for an advanced instrument on the sun.
Right.
Which is the reason we backed Paul's heliograph. So that made a coherent whole out of our program. And that has led up to the next logical proposal, which is still in the mill, of course, is the millimeter wave dish.
Right.
I'll be going for something like a 75 to 100 millimeter wave dish.
Let me ask, in particular, the Parkes dish and the Kogura array, maybe for others, not that I know of anyway, it was largely American money that made them possible. Was the Australian government, it seems like such a marvelous record that CSIRO had put out.
The answer is that up to that time, the amount of money, the amount of capital money that had gone into radio astronomy was very small. There was a lot of budget, year-by-year money, that went in to support that effort. Naturally, it was quite a considerable sum, running up to $500,000 a year or something. And we were extremely lucky to get that backing.
Mm-hmm.
But what we couldn't get was capital sums in addition.
Yeah.
In fact, by comparison with UK or US, we were very bad.
Right.
So the only way to make progress was to explore